This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
You're listening to the Reversing Climate Change podcast by the team at NORI, the carbon removal marketplace. This is a show about the innovators and entrepreneurs developing solutions to climate change.
Hello and welcome to the Reversing Climate Change podcast with NORI. I'm Ross Kenyon. I'm one of the co-founders of NORI and the director of creative and marketing here. Today I have with me Tamar Adler, a Chez Panisse alum and the author of several books, including Something Old, Something New, The Everlasting Cookbook, Leftovers A through Z, and An Everlasting Meal, Cooking with Economy and Grace. And you're also the author of The Kitchen Shrink, which is a Substack that you're producing. Thanks for being here, Tamar.
Thanks for having me.
I'm trying not to be like a little too starstruck, but I am a little bit because you've helped me out so much. I've long experienced cooking as fairly stressful, and I've plateaued. I felt like there's a couple things that I could cook kind of well, and as long as I stayed within those parameters, I was somewhat safe, but it was a suboptimal safety zone. And An Everlasting Meal was the first book that I read. And I've read lots of books on food that I felt pretty well unstuck me. It was a very elegant slap in the face. It's a beautiful book to read. And it chilled me out, made cooking more fun and easier, and the output better. I don't know how you achieve all of those things at the same time. It sounds like it was just a Pareto improvement with no cost, essentially. And I imagine I'm not the first person to tell you that, which means it's probably a running theme for people kind of like me. What did we miss along the way about cooking? How did we put ourselves in a position where it is stressful and difficult and hard to learn?
Well, I'm so glad that the book helped you. That's so wonderful to hear. And people have told me that it's helped them, but every single time it feels... it just feels like all of the work that I have put into trying to help people cook is bearing fruit. And so that just makes me so happy. I'm glad. I don't know if it's that we're missing things about cooking. I think there are a lot of parts of our culture and society right now that conspire to make cooking difficult and also conspire to make it seem like something that it isn't. What I talk about a lot in An Everlasting Meal and also in my most recent book, The Everlasting Meal Cookbook, is to what a great degree cooking is not a like a concrete, very staccato process. That cooking really is ongoing. It's kind of like a tide more than it is a kind of photo still. You know, it's not a single event. It has to be an ongoing process, and it is, and it always has been. I think right now in time culturally, it's really hard to understand that because there aren't that many examples of it, and because we mostly get cooking through media that make it seem very sort of concrete and like photo stills, like you start at the beginning and then you stop at the meal. What I've written about is that that's not the case. That doesn't make sense for anybody. Nobody can do that. And I even just yesterday I just wrote a kitchen shrink column. It's called The Mystery of Mr. Eat to Live, because somebody wrote me and said, here's my Zen question, how do I make time to cook? And my response ended up being very much about the same thing, that cooking isn't what we think it is. And that is what makes it so hard. But if we can see what it actually is, it's much more doable.
Yeah, that's a beautiful, thoughtful answer. I think once I started treating it less like a chore that I had to complete for my family and something that was pleasurable for its own sake, it's not something to get through so I can go watch the movie I wanted to watch or the activity I want to do, but it was actually the thing itself. Even Sunday meal prep with my family became a really fun thing rather than the, oh God, we got to do that today. And I think that that shift was at least partially inspired by your work, where this could be a zone of creativity and joy and not drudgery. And for a lot of people, I think cooking feels like drudgery.
Yeah. Well, so why did it become fun? Do you remember what shifted for you?
I think one of the things in an Everlasting Meal that started me thinking this way was just get some beautiful vegetables from the farmer's market and just cook them. Not everything has to come out hot. In fact, we fetishize hot food in a really perilous way. And just start thinking about making stuff ahead of time that can be transformed later in the week, even if you don't know how yet. Some of those basic transformations can unlock other types of creativity. So you don't just have an entire fridge full of raw things, but you have things in various states of transformation that can then be recombined. And it opened up a lot of new configurations that I hadn't previously conceived. I think that was the first step.
I babbled a bit when I answered your first question, but I think you just put it really well, which is sort of what's so hard is thinking that we have to do all of our cooking right before a meal. And what it sounds like you started doing, and what I always recommend that people do, is do small amounts of cooking all the time and then take advantage of the cooking that you've done, so that you're never starting from absolutely nothing. And you're never at the end. You know, you kind of have something to work with all the time, which makes it so much easier. The same way, you know, like we know this about from like behavioral economists and stuff, like it's so much easier to do anything when the cognitive lift is a little bit lower, when it's a lighter cognitive lift. And you know, when you have some like squash cooked or some rice cooked or whatever, it's that much more of a meal that you already have cooked, and you don't have to start from absolutely nothing.
That's definitely a huge part of it. And then also, I have found plating to be historically a trigger for me, because I want everything to come out so it's hot, it hits the table, everyone's happy, and you know, there's steam pouring off of it in the most cinematic way. And that has been hell.
Yeah, and it sounds like hell.
it very rarely actually works out like that. I often feel like one thing has become cold in the plating of the other, and then there's an expectation that it will come out hot. And I just relaxed that, and I feel a lot better about it now. And then you've also just said a lot of things are good cold. In fact, a lot of things are good several days after they've been cooked. They've sort of become themselves in the process of waiting patiently for you. That's a beautiful thought.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of wonder also where that kind of made up orthodoxy about hot food even comes from. Like what I was just picturing when you were talking was like kids' cartoons, you know, where you see like the cartoon steam lines coming
out. Like the rotisserie chicken.
And yeah, with like the little lines coming out of it. Yeah. Like where it's entirely manufactured, right? It's not even real food. It's just, and I'm like, maybe that's where it comes from. You know, having seen like as kids, you see these like fake steam lines coming off of cartoon food signifying hot. And you're like, food must be hot. Because that's not even true. I mean, it's just not true anywhere. It can't be.
I mean, there are places where it's distinctly false. I think if you serve meat that hot, it probably hasn't rusted. So it's probably not at its peak anyways, right?
Yeah. And like heat lamps in restaurants are very rare. Like that's a very kind of like, I don't know, that seems like a kind of antiquated thing. No,
do they just let food cool at the pass? They don't do heat lamps really anymore?
No, they I mean, some places have heat lamps. Everybody stresses and runs around and makes sure that they get everything to the pass at exactly the same time. But like, that's, you know, that's stressful. Nobody does that at home. And you shouldn't, you know, that's like, also you've got all people getting different, you know, when you have one person getting fish and one person getting steak and one person getting couscous, that's a different operation than like you're just giving everybody the same meal. I think that's part of going back to your first question. Restaurant food and home food are different. We are not trying to make our homes into restaurants. We totally shouldn't. That would be awful. Yeah, I don't that's a thing where like I understand that we see a lot of restaurants on TV, or like see a lot of chefs acting restauranty, but it's not pleasant, and it's not the same thing.
Yeah, and do you want your sacred domestic space feeling like the bear? I don't, that's sort of how I experience it. I'm like internally, my super ego is just yelling at me to make sure everything is hot and perfect
No,
and
yeah, no, that's
ruining my life.
terrible. I didn't, I mean, yeah, I didn't even, I didn't watch that show because I didn't really need to see that again. Like, I don't, you know, there are lots of things where we, you know, we acknowledge that they function differently on a professional level and on a domestic level, right? Like, we don't, or on a commercial level and on a domestic level, we don't. Tons of stuff. Like you know, it's fun to sit and make a birdhouse with your child, and like, you know, she gets glue everywhere, and you guys have made a little birdhouse, and it's a sweet, tender birdhouse that you then put up in your backyard. And you don't compare it to like a, you know, beautiful Thai, like ancestors, carved ancestors house that you buy in Bangkok, and you see like a, you know what I'm talking about? They're like beautiful outdoor houses. But like, you don't sit there and go like, oh, I really should have had a lathe, and like, I should have whittled away these, you know, the molding. You're like, no, I made this with my child. That is the work of a professional. We don't have to, you know, it's not the same thing, and it shouldn't be the same thing.
Yeah, I find that to be a very grounding thought. What is it about leftovers that always feels so second best? I like your rehabilitation of the idea of leftovers, especially as regards to things like soups. You're saying like the first day is actually not even the best anyways, and it's okay to wait. But I feel like if I told someone that, they'd be like, that serves your interests a little too well, and you're just trying to serve me something that you made several days ago because you're lazy.
Well, first of all, that is just a, they're just wrong. And I'm sorry that they are not yet educated in the,
Ruthless tomorrow.
it's soup. I always feel bad when I serve soup. The day I make it, I feel like I, so like for a different perspective, I feel like I could not get ahead of my game. Because if I was really like on the, you know, if I were really staying organized, I would have made the soup the day the before. Because I even just a couple months ago when it was still summer, I made friends who are professional chefs, and they make really delicious food. I was baking them papa al pomodoro, which is literally stale bread tomato soup. Made of like it was like some of the liquid that was left over from blanching tomatoes to freeze them, and then some kind of like rotting tomatoes and some frozen tomatoes. It was just like all over the place. Super delicious, but so much better the next day. And I'm philosophically opposed to ever apologizing for what you serve somebody, but I did have to bite my lip the entire meal while they were like, oh, this is so delicious, and be like, don't apologize for not having made it yesterday. And indeed, that when I tasted it the next day, I was like, this is, see, this is the soup. There are so many things that we acknowledge, you know, need aging. So many things. And like, this is an example. It takes, you could even think of it as like, it actually takes 48 hours to make great papa al pomodoro. You have to, the first, you know, like you do the original cooking, and then you have to put it away and let it like, you know, chill, age. I did serve it the first day, so I'm not saying you should be like a reverse snob, but it was better 24 hours later, and it was the very last time I had it. It was like just transportive, just epically delicious.
Wow.
Yeah, it, I mean, think we, it's again just kind of like a shift in our kind of cultural orthodoxy. I think we live in a culture that really places a premium on things being new, but you know, we all, Americans travel to Europe all the time where a premium is placed on things being old and marvel at it and are so happy at the old architecture and the old recipes and the, you know, it's just, it's all about preservation. It's an entire, you know, continent that places that premium on what was. And I think it that makes it hard to acknowledge in our culture, because it just doesn't really vibe with the compulsive need to make new things and buy new things and come up with new things and grow new things, to acknowledge that the old thing is good, like maybe even better.
A lot of your work has this theme. I mean, something old, something new certainly does. But one of the tasks that I self-imposed upon myself and my office was to cook an entire leg of lamb in the Robert Farrar Capone, the Supper of the Lamb style.
Amazing.
Which, I had to justify that expense on the company card. I am, this show better be damn good tomorrow. You better start bringing it.
I think it already is good. Look, we've gotten old is better than new. What else? Well, we'll ratchet it up.
Ratchet it up. No, I'm loving it. I'm obviously just teasing. This is what I loved about it and what I understood, and maybe I can run this by you and tell me if I've internalized the lesson that you're pointing to here, and he is as well, is that the old way of cooking meat was not always at the center. So all of these dishes with the leg of lamb, the goal is to have 30 something servings come off of a single leg of lamb, but a family could just, you could roast this in the oven and that family would demolish that leg in one sitting and not think anything of it. But his way of cooking it in various different braises and stews and fried rice and using the bones to cook down into stock, this is a way of really using every part of it that almost reminded me of old peasant cooking, essentially, of just really trying to make sure that the animal is a way of storing calories for hard times, and you're making sure that you've maximized this and honored the animal that died to sustain you. And I thought that was a really beautiful lesson of how wrongly we are eating meat. And also, it was just a series of beautiful, tasty meals as well. It wasn't like I gave anything up. In fact, I found this to be very creative and fun and slow in the best kind of way. Did I do this right? Do you agree with what I'm saying?
I completely agree with it. And I've toyed periodically with writing something about the corruption of materialism, which I know this sounds super, super digressive, but it isn't, in the sense that I feel like we misinterpret what real materialism is. And I completely forget now who said this, but another religious writer, obviously Robert Farrar Capon was a priest.
He was was a defrocked, or he like gave up being an Anglican.
Oh, really?
Or like a, yeah, vicar. I don't really understand. I mean, he's a strange man, whatever happened.
I love him. I love him. I don't know about his defrocking. I'll read up afterwards. But there is something religious about that incredibly preservative and conservative treatment of a living thing. But it also strikes me as a version of what this other religious writer, whose name I now am totally blanking on, said, which is God doesn't hate material things. God invented them. And the idea of that is that it's not terrible to love things, to love the material world, but to love something is to treat it with care and cherish it and cherish every part of it. And I love how religious that is, because that is the approach to food that I take and that makes the most sense to me. But that's not out of some sense of moral superiority. It's like the cheapest and most delicious way to eat. And what happens when you cook a single leg of lamb and then make a gajillion meals out of it is, of course, you are truly cherishing that material, right? Like that, everything that went into that is sort of being all that went into it is being amortized in your enjoyment of it, and how many, and your engagement with it, how much you're thinking about it, and then the conversations you're having, and then the gathering around the table, and then this conversation, we're talking about it now. You are eking so much life out of that single leg of lamb, and it deserves it. It carried a life. And I feel like that's, back to your leftovers question, I think the reason I treat leftovers the way I do is for the same reason, that when that the farrow that is left over grew on a stalk, and the stalk grew in soil, and the soil was part of a whole incredible ecosystem. And it all, and the more, and it makes me happy to talk and write about it, because it does feel like that's more payoff from the use of that resource. And so I just think it's so beautiful and meaningful to acknowledge that we're using resources. You're using resources, and a lot, with meat. Meat takes the most resources of anything. So particularly with meat, religion aside, you should be, since you are allowing all of those resources to be used on your behalf, you should be making a lot of it.
Like the religious or spiritual focus on this as well. I like that in cooking in this way, it's not disembodied, it's very embodied as well. And I have a leg that I have sawn through and interacted with and see, and working with my son on it too, and being like, this came from a lamb. We're trying to honor it and use every piece of it. I'm trying to make sure that an animal died to feed our family. How can we best make the most use out of this and not be wasteful or flippant about an animal's life? I tried to be nearly so didactic about it at every moment,
I
but
was picturing my son. If I said that, he'd be like, "Mom,
you'd be like, you're embarrassing.
viral."
Stop. But I don't know. Kids sometimes are a little more subtle than that. So I just try to make it's clear, like, this came from an animal. It's not just something that like falls out of the sky into a piece of wax paper and you're done with it. And it's good. We got it from a good place. I got it from Beast and Cleaver, which is a whole animal butcher that's down the street in Seattle, and they're incredible. And they also do a bunch of old world, like we got black pudding from them recently, and they do
Ooh.
all sorts of strange pates and terrines and foie gras and stuff, but sourced very well. So like, an animal that came from a place where it was loved and treated well. It went through the slaughtering process in a way that was well treated. And then afterwards, it was honored all the way through. And I think that has made me, yes, I'm still talking about it. I'm still thinking about it. I'm still appreciative of it in a way that the steak that I got, the New York strip or whatever, that thing's long gone. I'm not thinking about that anymore. And I think one of the things I also like about that too is that if you aren't that great of a cook, you can often substitute time for skill in a way that I think
Totally.
really makes cooking better. And I thought this was a good example of that.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I also think there was something really valuable and noteworthy in what you were when you were describing the butcher shop. It sounded, all of the things that you described them carrying could sound like delicacies, do sound like delicacies. You said
They are.
pate, foie gras, black pudding, all of this stuff that could, if let's say somebody was just tuning into this right now, they could hear that list of things and think of gourmandism and elitism and only the finest and French delicacies and like pate, da, da, da. All of those things are, of course, whole animal ways of using the whole animal. And even though foie gras does come from the gauvage process, where you're force feeding ducks or geese grain, it is still using the liver of a bird. And the same, I mean, pâtés exist because people who have raised animals have always wanted to use all of the animals, and more than wanted, needed to use all of the animals. And so I think it's really interesting that all of these things that they're selling, that the butcher shop is selling as delicacies, and things that could sound costly or sort of like only a fancy person would buy them, are ways of making the most of every single animal that is killed. And I think that's a place where like great cooking and great economy, or spiritualism and gourmandism, or cooking in general, and pleasure intersect. And those are the places where we should, we're so lucky, we're so privileged that these things intersect where they do, because it means, like, if you really want to have something delicious for, for an appetizer, you buy pate. But that pate also means that, a pig's liver and all kinds of other parts don't go out the back door. They go into a gratin, or a tureen, or whatever.
Yeah, I think that is a beautiful thing, and made me wonder if that was something that, New York City, that estuary was littered with oysters, and they were the cheapest thing that you could eat. And now, I barely had any the other day and got a $70 bill and wanted to scream. I'm in
Where was
Seattle. I think I got like 13 of them or something. I think they were ended up being like $5 a piece, and I didn't check, and I ended up in way over my head.
Think about it
But
this way. Other things were way worse back when there were a lot of cheap oysters.
that's true. I'm sure they
There
were dumping horrible sludge in there, and yeah.
and the lives of a lot of people were a lot worse. So,
Well, that's true.
I think it stinks that it was $70, but we're still all said, still better off, even though the oysters were like a cent a piece.
Well, yeah, I'm not going to take the other side of that argument. Don't try and put words in my mouth like that. Well, I don't want to make that trade either. It's more just the transformation of these things that used to be sort of proletarian fare, and now they're not. Like, was that the same with pate, where now it's associated with high class luxury? Maybe foie gras always was, because that is a decadent thing. But maybe organ meats, despite being, very nutritious, I imagine those were not the first choice of the aristocrats who were living in the manor.
Yeah, not at all, right? That's where that it's what you said about peasant cooking, you know. So much of what we now treat as a delicacy came from necessity, and certainly pâtés and all that are part of it. And to your point about time, they're things that take very little investment other than time, right? Like you already have the innards and the offal, and all you have to actually have to commit to it is like willingness to sit around, willingness to keep it, clean it, smush it all together, season it, and cook it.
Not even just for meat either. A lot of your writing has to do with the same holds for vegetables as well. There are plenty of parts that maybe are not primarily edible, but are secondarily edible. You can turn them into broth, or under the right treatment can have second life. And it might otherwise go in, if you're lucky or good, it would go in your compost pile or in your municipal compost, but otherwise it'll just end up in a landfill. And there are plenty of ways to retreat ingredients that you might not even think of as ingredients. And that's, food waste is a big thing people in climate change talk about a lot. And this is one of the places where maybe your work dovetails with that thinking.
Yeah, I think it. I think where it dovetails the most clearly is when it comes to pleasure and appetite, because I think that the issue happens when we talk about food that is actually good food as waste. We talk about it as, you know, it's not waste until we say it is, and it's not particularly wholesome or morally superior to like cook your waste or you know not or do like not I'm not gonna throw I'm gonna throw nothing away. I think that the because like nobody I don't think that's a good driver of behavior, and I don't think anybody, you know, it's like the same way the only thing that we know about diets is that they guarantee weight gain. That's like the only thing that we know about any kind of restrictive eating. 100, 98% of the time it means you'll gain weight. So like don't do that. That's not a good idea. And with throwing out food, I think that holding oneself to some standard of I'm not throwing anything away or like I'm a food waste warrior could result in the kind of like feeling like, oh God, I just want to friggin' get Mexican takeout and throw all of the, you know, and just like, I'm just gonna get all this stuff and eat what I want and then throw the plastic containers in the garbage and throw the leftover beans in the, you know, whatever. And I don't want to be good anymore. Because it's really hard to be good. And so the reason I think pleasure matters is because if you just focus on things being delicious, wanting things to taste as good as they can with the actual materials that you have, that in and of itself is that's a hedonistic reason to use everything that can be used. And if you can just go with that, and then there's nothing to rebel against, there's nothing restrictive, you're not being good, You're just making good food. And that's what I always want to encourage. There, for my most recent book, which is a leftovers encyclopedia. So it's like you could either think of it as like the Cliff Notes version or the advanced version. I think it's of an everlasting meal, because you
Yeah, I
can
think that's
look up
right.
anything. It could be either. But I had originally, when I was writing that book, I wanted to put in recipes that were like not really, some of that were just mediocre, and have a guide, like a little visual guide, so that if they were just mediocre, if they were great, you'd have like a mouth with the tongue out, or like a thumbs up. And then if they were like kind of good, you'd have somebody being like, eh. And then if they were like, only make this if you're starving, I would have another sign, like thumbs down, or like that, here's a thing you can do if you have to, but don't do this unless you have to. And then my editor told me not to do that, which I think was a good idea. Was a good idea. That was not my idea was not a good one. But I'm really glad that I left them out, because I realize now that the most important thing, the best and clearest way to use all that we can is to use it all well, and that putting in mediocre recipes could have actually encouraged the other kind of behavior, where you're like, oh, I guess I can make this thing with kasha, but now I feel like I've, done an extra good deed, and I'm gonna, compensate by, I don't know, with Cool Whip or something.
It's a really wise way to thread that needle. I like that too. It's also just not sustainable in the same way that diets are not. You might say that this is a lifestyle change. It's a new way to approach cooking. This is not something like, just cut out this, or if you make anything, use 100% of that, even though it's terrible, even though you hate it, even though your body is going to rebel against it, and you're going to break all these rules that you've set up for yourself for essentially no reason. So in effect, you might end up on net worse off than when you started after reading Tamara Adler's books. I haven't personally experienced that, but the wrong person might read your book if it had that wrong taxonomy of smiles and ruin their lives essentially for
Oh,
food.
ruin their lives. Yeah, I just think, like, I don't think that trying to be good is fair to yourself. And I think that, thankfully, that's not what you have to do. You can just try to make good food, and that will re it will have a more lasting result.
You're cracking me up because you are so good with words. I don't like flattering guests too much, but it's really a beautiful book. I think there are many parts of it that I ended up circling, just being like, this is just beautiful for its own sake. And what did you just say? I don't know that it's wise to be good. What did you
I
just
don't
say?
know. You're making me very self-conscious,
Just,
Ross.
I
I
know
don't
that's the thing.
know.
That's why you don't want to do that to guests sometimes, but
No. Thankfully, I have this dog here to pet. So I have like a therapy. I have a therapy dog. So I will try to metabolize that, all of that flattery quickly.
When hosts say nice things about you have to just outsource that to dog love, and
The
it's
dog.
that's the only thing you can do. Is that I know that we spoke about this a tiny bit about how some of the climate and food angles are maybe less interesting. I don't want to put words in your mouth. I don't know how you would describe it, but maybe not something that is as exciting to you as perhaps I might have thought, given your work on leftovers and thoughts on meat and things like that. Is what you just said a pretty accurate way of rebelling against the climate and food link in your preferred way, or is there more to it?
No, I think that I have, I think my argument against making too much of a connection between individual food choice and climate change is a little bit crotchety, and is the same argument as, kind of realizing that BP invented the idea of carbon footprint. Right, that too much attention to individual behavior can obscure the systemic problems. That is all that it is. And I worry about people feeling complacent because of small good choices. The largest you know, the problems with resource use are not limited to and cannot be solved by individual choice. So like, it's awesome to, you know, use silicon bags instead of plastic bags, and to make banana peel curry, which is delicious, and to save and reuse your tinfoil, and like all of these, all the small choices that we can make are great. And I think I have, you know, I've kind of at different points in the past sneered at them a little bit, even though they're how I live and they're what I write about. So it seems a little bit hypocritical, but I think what I want to say is, it's really important not to lose focus on the larger issue, which is our food system writ large is a really big problem. It's owned by a couple of small corporations. It's incredibly resource intensive. It is absolutely exhausting to land and humans. And we, it, you know, that is not, it's connected a little bit in that I think of being able to use all of what you have, being able to use all of your leftovers, being able to use all of your ingredients and all of your meat as a kind of sovereignty. Like, when you can do all of that, you can be less reliant on this very destructive food system, which is good, right? It means that they don't have quite the same hold over you, and you don't need to go back to the big supermarket and buy the boneless, skinless meat. That kind of keeps, it allows the system to keep grinding. So that's good. That degree of self-sufficiency is important. It's not just good. It's important and necessary. At the same time, individual food choice, individual food waste is not the problem. The fact that, you know, blah, blah, subsidies, blah, blah, non-conservation, blah, blah, big corporations, you know, it's capitalism, dummy, is the thing that I, when I'm feeling crotchety, that's what it comes down to, right? It's I don't care if you keep the top of your strawberries and, you know, your strawberry leaves and use them in a salad. It's capitalism, dummy. You know, that's the crotchety version. I just don't want it to, it's not an individual choice thing. And the fact that so many people can't make individual choices is bound up in a larger system called capitalism, dummy. You know, so it's like that whole, you know, so I know it sounds like a little bit, I don't know. I think it I don't want to sound cynical. I think all of that sounds a little cynical, and I, you know, loving life, loving all of the materials in your life, feeling resourceful, feeling ingenious, you know, feeling competent, all of that matters so much to even having the energy to hope to make changes to the systems that are actually destroying the planet. So in that way, also, food matters.
It's a thoughtful answer. I think whenever there has been a question of does... What?
No, it's like I babbled for 10 minutes and said it's capitalism, dummy, four times. It's kind of thoughtful.
QED. What else is there to say? No, I think I think whenever there is a question of this collective action versus individual agency question, this comes up everywhere, and it comes up in the case of individual carbon footprints and other places within climate. But one of the things I have read is that believing that you have no agency, even if your agency is extremely circumscribed, is, as far as happiness goes, very bad for you. And something like the way that you describe your experience with cooking, even inside of a admittedly imperfect system, there's a lot of joy that can be had there. And I think joy, finding joy to make your individual action independently meaningful to you, independent of a broader societal effect, I think that is one potential way out of that classic sort of dichotomy, at least for your own personal happiness. And hopefully if enough people can find joy in that, maybe some of those decisions add up to something else. Or maybe it's just necessary but not sufficient, and it will never be good enough to do it that way. I don't know.
Right, but it's not, I mean, you're right. It's a false dichotomy. And I think that's definitely the way out, right? There's no, there's no point without joy and pleasure and community and ritual. And the more you can do, if you just even approached it from the perspective of what is the most like personally sustainable way, not environmentally sustainable way, but how can I gather people around most regularly, most affordably, most economically from a time perspective, you would land in the same place, right? It's like using all of everything and saving my stale bread. That's the answer. So just that. And of course, if we don't gather, then we're screwed. So I, you know, we have to gather, we have to perform the rituals of moving through life together. That would have to happen for any system to change anyway.
I have a question that might be a little on the personal side, but your writing strikes me as being very literary, more so than lots of cooking writing I read. I read plenty of brilliant cooks who do not write with the same type, but clearly you like literature. Clearly you love working with words. It's very obvious reading it. That's not true of everyone. But would your life not be easier if you weren't trying to appeal to nerds like me, but were writing this like how to be a climate cook at home, and you wrote the book that, you know, was immensely popular and sold thousands and thousands of hardcover copies? Is there not like a little bit of, did I make the wrong turn here?
Yeah, there is. There's so many. Yeah. Yes, yes, yes. You're like, Ross, you just gave word to like my deep crisis. Wow. I wish that I could fully. And I mean, I wonder that all the time, and I keep on doing it too. It's not like I wrote my first book, which is, you know, this kind of like a book of very meditative essays about cooking in a more sustainable, more sort of more holistic way, I guess. And then I just couldn't let it go. I've kept on writing sort of like these not terribly commercial books without really zingy words, like even Zero Waste. Yeah, like The Climate Chef or Zero Waste. I haven't used any of those. I definitely wonder why I can't just use the words that sell the books and then also write the books in the words that everybody is sort of accustomed to using, or maybe is Googling at that moment when everybody's thinking about zero waste. I don't know. It's a problem of mine, but it's not, but you know, I guess luckily it keeps me from being too much of a hypocrite, because you don't make very much money if you don't do commercially viable things. So my engagement with capitalism stays more minimal, perhaps. But I don't think of it in those terms. And also it seems kind of cheap. I wish I could do it. It doesn't seem cheap to use phrases that actually are ones that are, that people connect to. That seems great. Like zero waste means something to people, to readers, and that's great. And I wish I could use it. I end up, you can even tell from, you know, I speak in Henry James-esque length clauses.
You do, yeah.
And so I don't like when there's just one symbol for something, like, you know, zero waste, when that refers to a whole field that I can't define. And I feel like there's always more that I want to say about it. But I do think there's real value in using terms that are easily accessible. And I wish that I could do it, because I think my books would reach more people and I would make more money.
Well, it maps on to what we've been saying earlier too, about this, your writing might be, no, might require a bit more engagement, because some of the cookbooks out there, they're really recipes. And often if you're cooking by the book, you are going to the store and you are getting those three artichokes exactly. And they weigh this much and whatever. and you're following it pretty, your work requires an intellectual investment where you have to think for yourself a little bit. Some of those cookbooks that feed it to you a little bit, there's a fast food element to them. They don't necessarily need you making improvisations based upon what's in season and what's in your fridge and what's about to go bad and what can you transform. It's like a way to think and a way to cook more than recipes. In fact, I pulled very few recipes out of an everlasting meal. There's some in there that I've used before, like the salsa verdes that has made the rounds around my home. But a lot of it has just been the way that I think and approach it generally. And I think that's a much more valuable thing to teach, but I'm not sure everyone is always ready to be taught such a lesson that requires such a cognitive lift.
Well, I mean, I think it can all go together, right? Like, I think a great, ideally, once you have sort of started thinking about cooking as a more continuous process, then you can apply that to all of the wonderful cookbooks that are out there. And like, sure, it's, the flip side of a recipe that has lots of ingredients and you have to go to the store for is that you can learn new flavors and and have access to cultures and their traditions that you wouldn't have otherwise. And so, like, I kind of think I could just be, I don't ever hope to supplant any of the other cookbooks in the world. And ideally I could be like a handmaiden to them. And even to ones that are, about zero waste and whatever, and have great graphs. And like, I'm not good at doing, kind of like poppy visual things. And, but like, hopefully, whoever understands things or engages with things best in kind of in text, can bring me with them when they encounter all the other cookbooks. And the reverse is true also. Like I read cookbooks constantly, and I get so excited to try something, or even just bring, a flavor or a spice or a method into what I'm doing otherwise. And so I think it's, as with anything, like it's learning, right? It's like it's being on a path and having all of your friends with you. And I just want to be, one of them. And I made this whole big to-do in my first book about recipes and how, not helpful they were because they start and stop in these very discrete places. And then my third book is literally like, I don't even know. I no, we were gonna put the number of recipes on the cover, but then nobody wanted to count them all. It's
It
so
says 1500 plus
oh
or something like
yeah,
that.
it's more than that. And so, and like,
Oh, wow.
they don't, they don't start with like free artichokes, but they start with any leftover you could have. But I, after 10, 10 years after having written kind of so scornfully about recipes, I wrote a book with thousands of them because maybe that's what people need. And I think whatever, I don't know, I'm too old to be, honestly, I think I'm too old to be disdainful. I think however, a person can find a path in and something that excites them, they should. And thank, and I feel so grateful to all of the people, even, all the people who are taking the time to write recipes, and who everybody connects, to somebody. And there's someone out there who's getting so excited about cooking from a book that I might, throw on the whatever, on the donate pile.
So I was too mean to the recipe
I
writers,
was being
it
kind of
sounds
mean
like.
too when I was like saying bad stuff about zero waste, because I think they're, I just, there's no, I'm not good at it. And I think it's not even meanness. I think it's like, I wish I could express myself in more commercial terms, and that can make me bitter. I think it would be great because I would reach more people. But that's not about the term. That's about my own inability to be concise.
Thanks for sharing all that. I think that's a pretty vulnerable spot. I think that's a beautiful thing to have shared and I think it's an honest part of writing books. People think when you write a book, you've got it made and it's done and you've arrived. And that is not actually how writing books works.
No, but there, I mean, you know, it is wonderful, right? It's so lucky, and I don't, it's lucky to be able to write books.
Are there more on the way?
Yes.
Yeah,
Yes. I'm
yeah.
not, yes.
Or is it
Yes.
like Substack territory? You're trying to, I imagine that's probably going to turn into a book. That's what people do,
Oh,
right?
I don't know. That hadn't occurred to me. No, that along with not being good at using any commercially saleable terms, I also don't have any of the like professional strategy so that you were that one might have. So it actually had never occurred to me to turn the Substack into a book. But I am working on another book, but I'm not gonna say anything else about it now. And then also another one. That is the sound of Fava Bean shaking
Wow.
herself. But yeah, I'm working on two books right now. And yeah, maybe the Substack could be a book. It's my favorite thing in the world because all I want to do is give culinary advice. Fava,
Well,
stop it.
next time
Fava,
I have an
stop it.
issue, I'm gonna be reaching out that way. Oh, sorry, were you talking to the
Well,
dog? What?
no, I was not about Substack, but about scratching the chair. But I would really love that. And the you know, what's so great about it is that also I often feel like I have nothing to say about cooking. Like I've said so much about cooking, what could there possibly be left to say? And answering people's questions solves that issue. You know, because it doesn't matter if I feel like I've said it in a book already. If somebody has the question, then they need, you know, I haven't answered it yet. And so I love that. I love that aspect of it, that even if I've said it before, I haven't said it either to them or in a way that makes sense to them. Arthur, what are you doing?
I've often
Sorry.
wondered if I was ever going to run out of podcasts to do, and part of it is being able to ask questions and read and keep making those connections. I think you have to find ways to do that. And I think maybe a relevant part of an everlasting meal here that I think is one of the standouts of the book is your chapter on how to fall in love with cooking again after you hate it and wish it did not exist at all. I don't know. I think there's a lot of good advice in there about how to redo that. Maybe you found your own way. Maybe it's answering questions as a way to review your own work. And yeah, you obviously have lots and lots of stuff to say here, but maybe you just need to repackage or new prompts. That can be exciting too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's like I have no, if I'm asked a question, my entire being rises up in like desire to answer it and to help and to find like a way to inform my answer so that it could, you know, be bigger than just yeah, I want to answer like not just the question, but where the question comes from. That is absolutely what I need. This is completely the writing version of how I get myself out of a cooking funk.
Great. Well, make sure you sign up for the Kitchen Shrink on Substack. I'll put a link very prominently in the show notes here. Pick up a copy of An Everlasting Meal. It's a wonderful book. I also like listening to it. That's available if that's your thing as well. Tamar, it was such a sincere pleasure to have you here. Thanks for taking a flyer on a climate food podcast where you're going to come on and dunk on everything I care about.
No, this was really fun. Thank you.
No, it's great. Thank you. Thank you so much for listening. If you could please subscribe and give us a great rating and review on Apple Podcasts or a rating on Spotify, that'd be much appreciated. It helps us get our content out to more people. You can sign up for our newsletter at nori.com, follow us on social media, and we will catch you next time.